I won't comment. It would take up the rest of the night. In any case, the camp is called Kengir. Later in Kengir, they increased the height of the dividing wall to 15 feet between the men's camp and the women's camp, and stretched barbed wire, too, along the top. They, obviously, the men and women were anxious to get at each other, so, okay? They keep building the wall higher, and finally they have to put barbed wire at the top. And then they added a high-voltage wire as well. Solzhenitsyn's comment, how strong that cursed Cupid is. And in addition to everything else, they put watchtowers at both ends of it as well. This Kengir wall had its own special destiny in the history of the whole archipelago. See part 5, chapter 12. I'll just mention this briefly. It was the one camp where there was a rebellion. Of all the thousands of camps, in this one camp, the prisoners finally rebelled, overthrew the guards, the camp leaders, and took control of the camp, and for 40 days lived as free human beings. And the stories that came out of there in terms of 40 days of graciousness, civility, joy, and love, having their own space, living freely in it, ended when the Soviets heard and sent in armed forces and killed every last one of them. But we cannot begin to grasp what it means to have a measure of freedom until we've lived in such circumstances, or how such freedom can be hated by those totalitarian forces that want to keep absolute control over everything. That's the camp in Kengir. Anyway, notes were thrown over the fence, or else left at the factory in prearranged hiding places. The addresses on the notes were coded, so the jailer, if he found them, couldn't work out who was writing whom. Galya Venediktkova recalls that sometimes people even made one another's acquaintance blindly, corresponded without seeing each other, and said farewell to one another blindly too, without ever having seen each other. Anyone who has ever conducted such a correspondence knows both its desperate sweetness and its hopelessness and blindness. In that very same Kengir, Lithuanian women were married across the wall to Lithuanian men whom they had never seen or met. And the Lithuanian Roman Catholic priest, also of course a prisoner in the standard pea jacket, would provide written documentation that so-and-so and so-and-so had been joined for eternity in holy matrimony in the eyes of God. In this marriage, with an unknown prisoner on the other side of a wall, and for these Roman Catholic women, such a marriage was irreversible and sacred, I hear a choir of angels. It is like the unselfish, pure contemplation of the heavenly bodies. It is too lofty for this age of self-interested calculation and hopping up and down jazz. What he saw, that's just magnificent. That is just magnificent. What he saw in the camps, what he learned through his suffering, made a believer out of him. Let me pause here to make an obvious point. If 20th century literary fashion teaches us anything, it is simply that you go along with the winds blowing in your time. Be blown by the literary winds and take the ideas that are out there. So almost all of the so-called major writers are atheists. And what they talk about in their lives is atheism and how meaningless life is and how horrible life is and how awful life is and how stupid it is to be alive and how boring the whole process is and how we really have nothing to do other than just endure here and shuffle along and finally wait for death to release us into absolute meaninglessness, where at least we won't know it's meaningless anymore, because we'll all just flop into the grave and be blessed with darkness and obscurity and emptiness forever and ever. And these people are honored They're given prizes, okay? Their books win awards, and it's very, very fashionable. And some of them became superstars, literary superstars. So that you could, at the same time that Solzhenitsyn was serving his time in the Gulag, have gone to Paris and walked along the Saint-Germain-des-Prés and gone to one of the bistros and found, for example, Jean-Paul Sartre, famous existentialist, sitting outside, sipping yet another cup of coffee, with his little beret on, spending a pleasant day in the Parisian sunset, and maybe ordering another baguette, and putting rich butter on it, and maybe having a nice glass of fine Beaujolais, and perhaps a little brie, and spreading a little brie on his bread, and maybe having another glass of Beaujolais, and then maybe ordering a cognac, while young university women from America flocked to his feet and threw themselves at his feet and said, "Speak, O wise one." And he would say, "Oh, the life is meaningless, is nothing. the life is empty, is void. The life, there is no life, is only the death. So here in this life, communism. Communism is the ideal." And this man was considered a serious intellectual. This man was considered one of the great philosophical thinkers of the age, as he rolled in money and comfort and acclaim, as he became stuffed with pride. I quote Solzhenitsyn from the Gulag, "Pride grows on the human heart like lard on a pig." And all these fine literary men just became full of themselves. And what was their message? It's all meaningless. And meanwhile, in the Gulag, crawling around in conditions that are unimaginable, suffering things that few human beings have ever had to go through, facing endless visions of torment, suffering, and death, a great writer discovered the truth of God's word. Nor should we be surprised that he came to the point where he could understand the importance of suffering and the vision of the crucifix. Making clear that the worst punishment of the age is comfort. That those literary figures sitting in bars in New York City, or in fancy restaurants in Paris, or shuffling about the hills of San Francisco, writing their beat poetry, are being punished immeasurably. And every award they win, and every time they are acclaimed as one of the great thinkers of the time, or as starting a revolution in poetic verse, they are being punished. And the great gift that God gave to literature and to a literary man was to have him arrested, sentenced, and shoved off in the gulag for nearly a decade. God's gifts are not the gifts the world seeks, but God, in his infinite wisdom, knows better than we do. He even knows better than those who give out literary awards. He was in the camps from 1945 to 1953 and determined someone had to tell the truth about what was happening in his country. And he decided it was his mission as a writer for the rest of his days to simply put down the truth. What had happened, what he had seen, what he knew. And that's what he did. He was sent into exile when he got out of the camps. They wouldn't release them right back into society. If you were lucky enough to get out, many didn't. Millions, millions, millions died in those camps. Solzhenitsyn himself says the actual number can never be known, but he estimates that between 60 and 70 million died in the camps, but there are another 30 to 40 million unaccounted for. Nobody knows where they went. And they probably were ground up in the camps as well, making the total somewhere between 100 and 110 million souls who died in those camps. You ask yourself why you don't hear about them. Well, those 100 to 110 million just don't have the publicity machine that certain other dead bodies from this century have. And also, those who punished them are still spreading their errors throughout the world. Those errors are still being spread, and those 100 to 110 million dead in Russia may just be an example set up for us, or a warning, that the rest of the world that numbers in the billions hasn't looked at or understood yet. In any case, he got out, was sent into exile because they couldn't be trusted. He was out in the middle of nowhere teaching mathematics in a tiny, tiny, tiny village, nowhere USSR, which he says again was providential. Because what it meant was nobody was paying attention to him, and as he lived there, he began writing. He began putting it down. They claim, and I've seen this, that his handwriting is microscopic. Smallest handwriting maybe ever on earth. Because he couldn't afford paper, and he wanted to keep it so small that people couldn't actually read it. So they wouldn't know what he was putting down if they came upon it. He could not keep the manuscripts together. He would read a little bit and write a little bit and hide it there, dig a hole in the backyard, shove it in a mouse hole, okay, give a little bit to friends. But he began writing fiction, novels about the camps and what he had seen in the camps, and then he was hit with cancer, stomach cancer. He went to a cancer institute where they said there wasn't much that could be done. They gave him what little treatment was possible. He had a tumor in his stomach the size of a baby's head. It was assumed he was a dead man. He describes returning back, going down on his knees and saying to God, "If you allow me to live, I will write a long nonfiction work that tells all the truth about those camps and Mother Russia." It was the way the gulag was conceived. The tumor shrank, went away, and has never come back. And he began work on his massive work, The Gulag Archipelago. It's in 7 volumes, 3 huge books. He started working on it at that point, digging out all the memories, what he had seen, what he had talked to, people he had talked to. He finished his years in exile and was allowed to head back into Moscow, but he was still working as a mathematician. He made friends, began trusting a few people, but not, sadly, his own wife, who one day, at a critical moment, betrayed him to the KGB. It shattered the marriage. The marriage never recovered. And some of his manuscripts began circulating underground, handwritten copies. It's very interesting. It's one of the first times I can think of, really, since the time of Scripture being written down and handed about. And then you would get it and you would make your own copy and hand it about. It was going on in the Soviet Union at that time with Solzhenitsyn's manuscripts. And people could not believe that he was actually telling this story. Because they knew if those in power got wind of it, he was a dead man. But he didn't care. And then in the early 60s, and I'll tell more of this story tomorrow night, came the thaw, what was called the Khrushchev thaw. When Khrushchev, having taken over, decided some little tiny squeak of truth had to come out, and began admitting in teeny tiny little ways that maybe Stalin overreacted. At that moment, he sent the manuscript, One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, to the most popular literary magazine in the Soviet Union. I'll go into that story tomorrow night as introduction to the novel. But what happened as a result is he wound up being published. One edition of the magazine was turned over to this book. It sold out instantly. It hit the Soviet Union like a bombshell. Everyone was talking about it. No one could believe it had been published. And at that moment, he began pulling out other work. A novel called The First Circle, about the time he spent in the special camp for mathematicians, physicists, chemists, those that the party needed because of their brains, and therefore they gave them a little special treatment so that they lived in a little more comfort so they wouldn't die and their brains could be kept alive and picked for the information that was up there. It's called The First Circle, of course, after Dante. When Dante begins descending in the Inferno, the first circle is where he puts all those great classical writers and figures. And Dante couldn't bear to condemn them to hell, although he knew they had to be in hell, so he puts them in the first circle where they're dwelling in the Elysian fields, living together in a rather nice castle, having a perpetual picnic in hell. Solzhenitsyn takes that phrase, the first circle, because those who were lucky enough to be scientists or mathematicians lived as if they were picnicking in hell. It's called The First Circle. It's a very, very great novel. I recommend it to you. It's an extraordinary piece of work. He also wrote a novel called Cancer Ward about his time dealing with cancer and in fiction form people he met as he was treated for cancer and what went on in those hospitals where they were trying to treat cancer at the same time that they were living in a totalitarian state. Not an easy thing to do. But of course the cancer itself becomes a metaphor for communism. It is deadly. It is growing. It cannot be stopped. It's spreading everywhere. And just as cancer destroys the body, the images of communism killing Russia. It's a powerful novel and a great book. One day in the life of Ivan Denisovich, the only one of his works to be published, by the way, in Russia during those years, went out to the West and was published and acclaimed instantly as one of the great works of all time, one of the masterpieces of Russian literature. He was proclaimed to be an heir to Tolstoy and Dostoevsky and those other great Russian writers, and he had the other works smuggled out as well. He couldn't just ship them out. He couldn't put them in a box and send them. There are two magnificent books by Solzhenitsyn, both autobiographical, but not autobiographies as most writers write them, telling about how clever he was and how he grew. No, this is about what it took to write his works and get them published. It's all about the impossibility of writing in that state. The first volume is simply called The Oak and the Calf, from an old Russian proverb that the calf keeps budding the oak, but the oak will not move. Well, that was the writer, the calf, Solzhenitsyn, budding the communist state that wouldn't budge. And then he promised at some later date he would tell the rest of the story called, and it finally came out, called Invisible Allies, who helped him with the typing, who got a hold of the manuscripts and held them, and who smuggled them out to the West. And they were held in the West, published there, and it became clear that this was a literary genius, and he won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1970. And of course, at that point, the communist authorities said, oh, please, yes, go to Sweden and get the prize. We encourage you to go. Please go to Sweden and collect this great prize. And Solzhenitsyn knew very well that as soon as he set foot out of the country, they'd never let him back in. They wanted to be shut of him. He refused to go and accept the prize and openly said in an open letter to the Nobel Committee, thank you for the honor, but if I come to collect it, I will be in exile for the rest of my days. My own country would not allow me to return. So he never, it wasn't until many, many years later that he actually collected the prize that he won in 1970. but the big work, the Gulag Archipelago, was completed, although, as he said, at no time was the entire manuscript ever on his desk at one time. He'd write a bit of it, he'd write a piece of it, he'd give it to a friend, it would be hidden here, it would go there, and it is a massive work. It is a very long work. It is an overpowering work. I call it, and I mean this seriously, the great work of our century. If the Greeks had Homer, if the Romans had Virgil, if the Middle Ages had Dante, if the Renaissance had Shakespeare, then our century, our time, has had Solzhenitsyn, and his great work is the Gulag Archipelago. Because it is a work about everything that defines this century. Totalitarianism, brutality, murder, horror, and the triumph of the human spirit, and the fact that God is watching over all of it. It's an extraordinary piece of work. It is a history, an autobiography. It is filled with short stories, true short stories of things that actually happened. It is a philosophy. I will read you one part of the sort of philosophical thinking, which, unlike Sartre, isn't just nonsense. It is grounded in something real. I'll end up there in just a few moments. In any case, there were rumors all over that this thing existed. And the KGB wanted to find it. But how do you locate a book that you can't prove even exists? And which, when you say to the author, we know that you're writing that, give us a copy, the author says, what book? He infuriated them. They tried to track it down. They made his life impossible. At this point, he remarried a woman who helped him through all of this after his first wife had turned him over to the KGB. I won't comment on that. I can't know about that. That's in God's hands. But they began to make his life so impossible, he had nowhere to live. No one would give him a place to live. Until finally, the great Russian cellist, Mstislav Rostropovich, and his wife, the leading soprano at the Bolshoi Opera, Galina Vishnevskaya, invited him to come to their home and live in a little house they had out back. It was an incredible act of courage, and the next day, all of Rostropovich's tours were canceled. I had a ticket to hear him, by the way, that year. He was supposed to come to Indiana University to play, and the concert was canceled. His entire American tour, his European tour, they would only permit him to go out to the provinces of Russia and play occasionally. The greatest cellist in the world. His wife went the next night to the Bolshoi Opera to sing Madame Butterfly and learned that she was singing Suzuki, the maid, instead. She turned around, walked out, and never set foot in the Bolshoi Opera again, although the next day in the record stores, every recording she had ever made throughout her entire career had her name blacked through. And she became a non-person, a non-singer. It didn't stop them. They kept Solzhenitsyn there. Until he finally, because he felt so guilty what he had done to their careers, left of his own accord. By the way, after that, they still would not allow them to perform. There's not much good to be said about the Kennedys, but here's a good Kennedy story. Teddy Kennedy and his then-wife, Joan, who I believe he dumped her, and I think she has subsequently died, but in any case, if I think that's the case, God rest her soul. They went to Moscow. They were guests of Brezhnev. There was a big state dinner, and Brezhnev, who was hitting the vodka heavily that night, was seated next to the lovely Mrs. Kennedy and said, you know, lovely lady, you have charmed me so. This last night in my country, if there's anything you want, ask it. It is yours. Expecting she'd ask for a big car or a mink coat, or maybe, you know, 2 pounds of caviar to take home with her. She turned to him, looked him in the eye, and said, let Rostropovich go. The next day, he signed the order. And Rostropovich was free to tour again. And in fact, he and Vishnevskaya shortly thereafter left the country. Amazing stories from these years. In any case, the KGB kept pursuing this book that may or may not exist, according to them. And they finally brought in an elderly woman who was a friend of Solzhenitsyn's, who indeed had a chapter of the book buried in her backyard. They did not allow her to sleep for 3 nights. They tortured her. And at the end of 3 days of sleeplessness and torture, she said, yes, the book exists. Yes, I can prove it. There is some of the manuscript buried in my own yard. The KGB went, dug it up, took it to the authorities, who read it and said, oh my God, it's worse than we expected. The woman went home and hanged herself, believing that she had not only betrayed a friend, but betrayed all of those souls who had died in the gulag. Again, God will judge. Word came to Solzhenitsyn that the KGB had the manuscript. As he said, he packed a little bag, said goodbye to his wife and his family, and prepared to be sent to prison where he would be killed. But before he went, he got on the phone to Paris and said, let the presses roll, because the whole manuscript was in the West. But he had not allowed it to be printed because he was afraid of what would happen to other people who were mentioned in the book. I remember the day, front page of every newspaper in the world. Nobody knew this book existed. He had already won the Nobel Prize. We're talking 1974. And suddenly it was revealed that Solzhenitsyn had written a massive expose of the Soviet slave labor camps. It was incredible. And excerpts appeared on the front page of every newspaper. And then indeed, instantaneously, he disappeared. The authorities came and got him, but they did the smartest thing they could have done. They put him on a plane and sent him to the West. He landed in Germany first, went to Switzerland, traveled around a bit, and finally came to rest in Vermont, where he lived for 20 years. When he arrived in Vermont, he went to the first town meeting that took place once he bought his estate, which he surrounded with brick and barbed wire, and went to the town meeting and said, I wish I could be a good neighbor, but unfortunately that is not possible. I have come to your community, and I am glad to be among you, but I am still not free. The KGB is threatening me, my wife, my children. I have to live behind brick and barbed wire for their safety and for my own. I hope to finish all my writing while I'm here, and therefore I cannot walk among you, but please know that I think of you and am very happy to be here with you. They applauded him and cheered him, and for the next 20 years, covered his tracks. If you went up there and tried to find where he was, they'd say, well, go down that road about 4 miles. Take a left. They'd just send everybody on wild goose chases. Because there were, in essence, literary pilgrimages being made. Everyone wanted to see him, meet him, talk to him. And he worked from sun up till sundown. He had a small chapel in the built in there, and there was an Orthodox priest who came regularly to say Mass. He worked, he listened to a little music, and that was his life, period. And he wrote a massive four-novel sequence about the Russian Revolution called The Red Wheel. Only the first two parts have been translated into English. It's all published in Russian now. The literary establishment dumped on it. It's a great work. I haven't finished it. I've only read half of it. I cannot comment fully. But the reason they dumped on it is he became as big a burr under the saddle of the West as he'd been to the communists. In 1978, he was invited by Harvard to give the commencement address. And he began by saying, Harvard's motto is Veritas, truth. Were I in my own country, there are many hard truths I would have to utter to them. But since I'm here and have been living among you for 4 years now, I have a few truths to tell you about the West. He proceeded to savage, liberal democracy, materialism, and most particularly, the media. The next morning, he became a non-person in the West. Every editorial page in the country dumped all over him, attacked him, and from that point on, stopped covering him. He was never invited to the White House by any American president during his 20 years here. It would have looked bad. As he said, he finished his major life's work. Communism supposedly, quote, fell, unquote. They began publishing more of his works in Russia, and he indeed returned there. Made a very famous whistle-stop tour. He came in from the west and took a train all the way across, stopping in all the little villages. But what happened, of course, was that the ideas, the errors of communism did not fall. They were not stopped. It was simply those materialists that didn't have any material finally opened up to the materialists that had lots of material. And what came pouring in was, as Solzhenitsyn himself said, the raw sewage of Western culture. In came McDonald's, in came Coca-Cola, in came the pus casserole CDs, in came Rambo movies, in came, and this is the most interesting one, in came Stephen King novels. And at the time when finally the Russian people could have freely read their greatest writer, they started reading Stephen King, although the bookstores themselves began to be closed down and replaced by supermarkets that traded only in cash. Don't ever be fooled. Russia has not been converted. I just today received an interview he gave. He doesn't say much now. He briefly had his own TV show there. Nobody watched. They've got Baywatch now, so they're not about to watch Solzhenitsyn on TV, okay? and much of what he says, very frightening, he simply says that, you know, the country is worse off now, 10 years later, than it was before. That's nothing but lies going forward. Our decline has lasted through 70 years under the communists and 10 years after that. We must not permit the death of Russia as a nation. A rebirth is always far more difficult. It will take at least 100 years. The demographic trends in our country are frightening. The nation loses 1 million people a year, so greatly does the death rate exceed the birth rate. A nation experiences losses like that only in wartime. Well, there is a war going on. It's between God and the devil. And the focus, as those of us who are Catholic know, somehow has much to do with Russia. And death is winning there now, but we know death will not triumph because Russia will be converted. Just so you know that he's still as feisty as ever, I just came across this, comments made almost exactly a year ago to this day. While the United States was busy bombing Eastern Europe, and this is the man at his best. Listen to the clarity of this. It's a voice speaking with a kind of authority that we just hear too rarely today, except in certain circles. Hurling aside the United Nations and trampling on its charter, NATO proclaimed to the whole world and to the next century an ancient law, the law of the jungle. He who is mighty is completely right. If you are technically superior, excel your condemned opponent in violence 100-fold. And they want us to live in a world like this from now on. In the sight of humanity, a beautiful country is being destroyed while civilized governments applaud. And desperate people leave bomb shelters and come out as living targets to die for the salvation of Danube bridges. Is this not antiquity? I do not see why Clinton, Blair, and Solana would not tomorrow burn and drown them. let me end with this very quickly. I mentioned the kind of philosophical side of him. I want to read one last story. This is from the Gulag. Following an operation, I am lying in the surgical ward of a camp hospital. I cannot move. I am hot and feverish, but nonetheless my thoughts do not dissolve into delirium, and I am grateful to Dr. Boris Nikolaevich Kornfeld, who is sitting beside my cot and talking to me all evening. The light has been turned out so it will not hurt my eyes. He and I, and there is no one else in the ward. Fervently, he tells me the long story of his conversion from Judaism to Christianity. This conversion was accomplished by an educated, cultivated person, one of his cellmates, some good-natured old fellow like Platon Karateyev, a figure from War and Peace. I am astonished at the conviction of the new convert, at the ardor of his words. We know each other very slightly, and he was not the one responsible for my treatment, but there was simply no one here with whom he could share his feelings. He was a gentle and well-mannered person. I could see nothing bad in him, nor did I know anything bad about him. However, I was on guard, because Kornfeld had now been living for 2 months in the hospital barracks without going outside. Because he had shut himself up in here at his place of work and avoided moving around camp at all, this meant he was afraid of having his throat cut. In our camp, it had recently become fashionable to cut the throats of stool pigeons. This has an effect. But who could guarantee that only stoolies were getting their throats cut? One prisoner had had his throat cut in a clear case of settling a sordid grudge, and therefore the self-imprisonment of Kornfeld in the hospital did not yet prove at all that he was a stool pigeon. It is already late. All the hospital is asleep. Kornfeld is ending up his story thus. And on the whole, do you know, I have become convinced that there is no punishment that comes to us in this life on earth which is undeserved. Superficially, it can have nothing to do with what we are guilty of in actual fact. But if you go over your life with a fine-tooth comb and ponder it deeply, you will always be able to hunt down that transgression of yours for which you have now received this blow. I cannot see his face. Through the window come only the scattered reflections of the lights of the perimeter outside, and the door from the corridor gleams in a yellow electrical glow. But there is such mystical knowledge in the voice that I shudder. These were the last words of Boris Kornfeld. Noiselessly, he went out into the nighttime corridor and into one of the nearby wards and there lay down to sleep. Everyone slept, and there was no one with whom he could speak even one word, and I went off to sleep myself. And I was wakened in the morning by running about and tramping in the corridor. The orderlies were carrying Kornfeld's body to the operating room. He had been dealt 8 blows on the skull with a plasterer's mallet while he still slept. And he died on the operating table without regaining consciousness. And so it happened that Kornfeld's prophetic words were his last words on earth, and directed to me, they lay upon me as an inheritance. You cannot brush off that kind of inheritance by shrugging your shoulders. But by that time, I myself had matured to similar thoughts. I would have been inclined to endow his words with the significance of a universal law of life. However, one can get all tangled up that way. One would have to admit that on that basis, those who had been punished even more cruelly than with prison, those shot, burned at the stake, were some kind of super evildoers. And yet, the innocent are those who get punished most zealously of all. And what would one then have to say about our so evident torturers? Why does not fate punish them? Why do they prosper? And the only solution to this would be that the meaning of earthly existence lies not, as we have grown used to thinking, in prospering, but in the development of the soul. From that point of view, our torturers have been punished most horribly of all. They are turning into swine. They are departing downward from humanity. From that point of view, punishment is inflicted on those whose development holds out hope. The section in which this appears, the core of the book, is called The Soul and Barbed Wire. And he ends it by saying, "Bless you, prison, for having been in my life." A recognition that without suffering, he never would have understood the truth. What do we have here, and why do I call him one of the few great men of the century? Because his messages are very simple and very clear, and he has not only put them down on paper, He has lived them. Number one, there is truth. We can know it. And when we know it, we must put it forward, whatever the cost. As he himself has written, one word of truth outweighs the whole world. Because the world is falsehood, and truth is eternal. Two, we must be courageous in standing up and fighting for the truth. The world will try to shout us down. The world will try to destroy us all the more as we put the truth forward. To put the truth forward in the world at any time demands courage. To put it forward in the modern world, in the world we find ourselves in today, demands superhuman courage. It demands the grace of God, which brings us to the third great message, suffering. We will not be worthy of God's grace unless we suffer. And through that suffering will come health of soul, a better understanding of the truth, and the courage to stand up for it in the world, no matter what the barbarians try to do to us. They can only kill our bodies. They can't get our souls. That this man should appear in Russia and send the word out because of what he learned there, in my mind, connects completely with the Fatima messages. And it's because of that message and the fact that some will hear it and adhere to it, and that God calls us all to suffer for the truth with real courage, suggests why one day it will be possible Russia will be converted through the grace of God, through the action of the Pope, listening finally to the message given to the world through the Blessed Mother. Russia will be converted through devotion to her Immaculate Heart, and a period of peace will be granted to the world. Can we deserve it? Do we deserve it? God in his goodness has promised it to us. But before we get there, we may all have to spend our time in a place quite distant from the comfortable modern material atheistic world, sipping fine wine in nice restaurants and being adored by the world around us. Tomorrow night I will talk about one of the novels, the first one that introduced him to the world, One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. Thank you very much.